White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Gentlemen and students of the International Jew, welcome to episode 70, in which is chapter 65. You know, I don't know what is going on with this mic at the beginning. Even though I use it before the show, it just won't pick up the sound right away. It drives me crazy. So I start watching the sound level, and that's why I can't open the show properly.
Well, you've got some kind of automatic level control there.
Well, it didn't used to work like this. I've had this
mic. Well, you see, what it is the music is much louder than you.
Yeah.
And so the receptivity of your system there goes way, way down, and then it slowly recovers.
But it didn't used to do it. It's only been a few months that it's been doing that. It never happened before.
Aren't you using a new computer?
No, I'm not. Still on the same one. So, I don't know, but I can't seem to quit from commenting on it and ruining the beginning of every program. Sorry about that. So, as I was saying...
It's all ruined now!
Welcome to episode 70, which is chapter 65, titled Angles of Jewish Influence in American Life, and is, once again, a hard-hitting piece of writing.
I am Carolyn Yeager, and I'm adding Scott.
And are you as impressed with this chapter as I am, Hattie?
This is a very good philosophical chapter. Although, I mean, it starts off that way anyhow. Toward the end, I think it makes some mistakes.
Well, naturally. Same old mistakes you always...
There goes that Hattie again.
Well, they're always the same. I know what you're referring to. I think I do. But anyway, I'm glad you thought it was very good. I thought it was quite excellent. And so I think that it's because the writers, their frustration is building up. You know, they've been writing this. This is chapter 65, and they've been doing this for so long now and expecting, I think, probably more reaction from the public than they're getting. So maybe they're amping it up a little bit, trying to get some reaction. And anyway, that's just an idea that I would have. This is kind of like a survey of current negative Jewish influence in the country, although they're speaking from May 1921. And it's mainly they're talking about the churches and universities and in attitudes toward money.
Money. But the main thing they're talking about is the work ethic versus acquisitiveness.
Yes.
And then it goes into... the teaching of this acquisitive attitude, which is the basis of the class struggle in universities. And then it goes into a discussion about religion, about Christianity.
Okay. I thought Christianity kind of came first, but we'll see. We will certainly going to find out right now. And he contrasts the Anglo-Saxon type with the Jew type real sharply, didn't you think?
Yeah.
Almost like you got the feeling I did that, you know, we need to get Jews out of here because they're not Anglo-Saxons and they're never going to be. And they're screwing up our Anglo-Saxon thinking and society. Yeah, we're pretty tough.
I know you never had that thought before about getting Jews out of here.
They try to be kind of, you know, soft about it, but they're not doing that so much anymore. Yeah. So if you want to go ahead and start.
All righty. Chapter 65, Angles of Jewish Influence in American Life. The Jewish question exists wherever Jews appear, says Theodor Herzl, because they bring it with them. It is not their numbers that create the question, for there is in almost every country a larger number of other aliens than Jews. It is not their much boasted ability, for it is now coming to be understood that give the Jew an equal start and hold him to the rules of the game, and he is not smarter than anyone else. Indeed, in one great class of Jews, the zeal is quenched when opportunity for intrigue is removed. The Jewish question is not in the number of Jews who here reside, not in the Americans' jealousy of the Jews' success, certainly not in any objection to the Jews' entirely unobjectionable Mosaic religion. It is in something else, and that something else is the fact of Jewish influence on the life of the country where Jews dwell. In the United States, it is the Jewish influence on American life. Now, that sentence there, he says, talks about the entirely unobjectionable Mosaic religion of the Jews. Mm-hmm. Later on, he explains that Judaism is, or the Jewish idea, something like, he makes a distinction between the Mosaic religion and
Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah. I recall that too. It struck me too.
Yeah. The Mosaic religion versus the Talmudic religion, I suppose.
Yeah.
That the Jews exert influence, they themselves loudly proclaim. One is permitted to think that they really claim a stronger influence than they possess, especially in those higher regions where excellent and determinative influences have been at work. The Jews claim indeed that the fundamentals of the United States are Jewish and not Christian, and that the entire history of this country should be rewritten to make proper acknowledgement of the prior glory due to Judah. If the question of influence rested entirely on the Jewish claim, there would be no occasion for doubt. They claim it all. But it is kindness to hold them to the facts. It is also more clearly explanatory of conditions in our country. If they insist that they gave us our Bible, and gave us our God, and gave us our religion, as they do over and over with nauseating superciliousness throughout all their polemic publications, not a single one of these claims being true, they must not grow impatient and profane while we complete the list of the real influences they have set at work in American life.
Well, I have this somewhere else because they bring this up some further on again, I guess. But I'll just say it here. You know, a lot of white nationalists say the same thing that the Jews say, that they gave us, Jews gave us the Bible and they gave us our God and they gave us our religion, our Christian religion is what they're talking about. And you're among those. So, you know, I just have to say
that. Not exactly. That's an oversimplification.
Okay, all right. But that's, then I won't include you. But they do that, and that's the same thing that the Jews have been doing, and they talk about this some more in here. So, you know, we'll get some more of it. But, you know, again, I always wonder when I find that what we're saying and what Jews are saying is the same thing, that there's a little, somebody needs to look at that. People who are saying the same thing.
There are a lot of different angles that could be taken to that assertion that none of those claims are true. Maybe we'll talk about that later. It is not the Jewish people, but the Jewish idea, and the people only as vehicles of the idea, that is the point at issue. As it was Prussianism and not the German people that was the objective in the recent war, so, in this investigation of the Jewish question, It is Jewish influence and the Jewish idea that are being discovered and defined. Well, it's leaning on war propaganda there a little bit. Probably saying something that was said during the war. It's not the German people that are the problem, it's Prussianism, right? Yeah. We don't hate those people, we just want them to change their idea.
That's right. That's right, there is this real hatred for Prussianism.
Yeah.
Because the Prussians were strong-minded.
Well, actually, Prussianism, a lot of Germans don't care for it either.
More southern Germans and people like that. But, you know, the Jewish and the British and so on objection to Prussianism was the same as what they are. You know, they didn't want the Prussians to be like themselves and have such strong feelings about winning wars and so on.
Yeah, well, it wasn't really true anyway, because in the Second World War, the propaganda incorporated the idea that the German people had a bad... What was that? Nathan Theodor Kaufmann, Germany Must Perish.
Mm-hmm.
Where the German people are inherently bad.
Yeah. But, you know, that was a kind of an extreme thing done for propaganda purposes, but... People didn't really believe it.
I think this thing about trying to separate the idea from the people is something that, you know, sort of upper middle class people indulge in to try to be nice, I guess. Try to, you know, they can go to war without being able that way.
Yeah.
But the fact is that in the case of the Jews, this Jewish idea does come from their heredity.
Well, we better go on because
are propagandists. This was originally their mission, but they were to propagate the central tenet of their religion. They failed to do this. By failing in this, they, according to their own scriptures, failed everywhere. They are now without a mission of blessing. Few of their leaders even claim a spiritual mission. But the mission idea is still with them in a degenerate form. It represents the grossest materialism of the day. It has become a means of sordid acquisition instead of a channel of service. You can look at Marxism as almost like an evangelical religion. Of sorts. Mm-hmm. The essence of the Jewish idea in its influence on the labor world is the same as in all other departments, the destruction of real values in favor of fictitious values. The Jewish philosophy of money is not to make money, but to get money. The distinction between these two is fundamental. That explains Jews being financiers instead of captains of industry. It is the difference between getting and making. This is also a very important distinction in National Socialist ideology. They talked about Schaffen des Kapital und Raffen des Kapital, making capital and taking capital.
Yeah. Finance okay. Capital. Although you better probably ought to speed up a little if we're going to get through this chapter.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll
comment on a few other things. That's pretty long.
The creative, constructive type of mind has an affection for the thing it is doing. The non-Jewish worker formerly chose the work he liked best. He did not change employment easily, because there was a bond between him and the kind of work he had chosen. Nothing else was so attractive to him. He would rather draw a little less money and do what he liked to do than a little more and do what irked him. The maker is always thus influenced by his liking.
You know, that's very, very true. And that's always been true of me. And, you know, I think they really, it's interesting to think that Jews are not like that, that that's not why they do things for the most part.
Yeah, they live for something that's external to themselves. And this also has ramifications for things like economic policy, where you want to preserve small enterprises and craftsmen so that people can be employed in ways that give them pride.
Yes.
And you'll have a more stable and happier society.
Right.
Not so, the maker is always thus influenced by his making. Not so the getter. It doesn't matter what he does, so long as the income is satisfactory. He has no illusions, sentiments, or affections on the side of work. It is the geld that counts. He has no attachment for the things he makes, for he doesn't make any. He deals in the things which other men make, and regards them solely on the side of their money-drawing value. The joy of creative labor is nothing to him, not even an intelligible saying. Now, previous to the advent of Jewish socialistic and subversive ideas, the predominant thought in the labor world was to make things and thus make money. There was a pride among mechanics. Men who made things were a sturdy, honest race because they dealt with ideas of skill and quality, and their very characters were formed by the satisfaction of having performed useful functions in society. They were the makers, and society was solid as long as they were solid. Men made shoes as exhibitions of their skill. Farmers raised crops for the inherent love of crops, not with reference to far-off money markets. Everywhere, the job was the main thing, and the rest was incidental. So this making is really a form of giving, actually. The only way to break down this strong safeguard of society, a laboring class of sturdy character, was to sow other ideas among it. And the most dangerous of all the ideas sown was that which substituted get for make. With the required manipulations of the money and food markets, enough pressure could be brought to bear on the ultimate consumers to give point to the idea of get, and it was not long before the internal relations of American business were totally upset, with Jews at the head of the banking system and Jews at the head of both the conservative and radical elements of the labor movement, and, most potent of all, the Jewish idea sowed through the minds of working men. What idea? The old idea of get instead of make, which is to say, really, take instead of give. The idea of get is a vicious, antisocial, and destructive idea when held alone. But when held in company with make, and as second in importance, it is legitimate and constructive. As soon as a man or a class is inoculated with the strictly Jewish idea of getting mine, getting while the getting is good, honestly if you can, dishonestly if you must, but get it. All of which are notes of this treasonable philosophy. The very cement of society loses its adhesiveness and begins to crumble. The great myth and fiction of money has been forced into the place of real things, and the second step of the drama can thus be opened up. That whole getting attitude is adversarial. He says antisocial. Adversarial is another way to put it. It's an attitude of somebody that doesn't feel any sense of community with the people from whom he wants to get. It's a predatory attitude. Or parasitic. Jewish influence on the thought of the working men of the United States, as well as on the thought of business and professional men, has been bad. Thoroughly bad. This is not manifested in a division between capital and labor, for there are no such separate elements. There is only the executive and operating departments of American business. The real division is between the Jewish idea of get and the Anglo-Saxon idea of make. And at the present time, the Jewish idea has been successful enough to have caused an upset. All over the United States, in many branches of trade, communist colleges are maintained, officered, and taught by Jews. The so-called colleges exist in Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Rochester, Pittsburgh, New York, Philadelphia, and other cities. The whole intent being to put all American labor on a get basis, which must prove the economic damnation of the country. And that apparently is the end sought, as in Russia. Until Jews can show that the infiltration of foreign Jews and the Jewish idea into the American labor movement has made for the betterment in character and estate, in citizenship and economic statesmanship of the American working man, the charge of being an alien, destructive, and treasonable influence will have to stand. The last place the uninstructed observer would look for traces of Jewish influence is in the Christian church. Yet if he failed to look there, he will miss much. If the libraries of our theological seminaries were equipped with complete files of Jewish literary effort in the United States during the past 15 years, and if theological students were required to read these Jewish utterances, there would be less silly talk and fewer easy marks for Jewish propaganda in the American pulpit. For the next 25 years, every theological seminary should support a chair for the study of modern Jewish influence and the protocols. Don't really agree with the
study. Well, that would actually probably really make a big improvement in how people understood things if they did add the protocols. But they were not. They're not. They never did.
Yeah, I don't agree with studying the protocols. But Ingrid Weckert, who wrote Flashpoint about Kristallnacht, she majored in Jewish studies in Germany. Mm-hmm. In Germany, Jewish studies is not primarily taken by Jews. It's taken by Germans that want to know about Jews.
Yeah. Right.
Which is what he's advocating here.
Right.
The fiction that the Jews are an Old Testament people faithful to the Mosaic law would then be exploded, and timid Christians would no longer superstitiously hesitate to speak the truth about them because of that sadly misinterpreted text. I will bless them that bless thee, and curse them that curseth thee. There is a mission for the pulpit to liberate the church from what the New Testament scriptures call the fear of the Jews.
You know, that sentence really does add to the fear of the Jews. And people do think that that's God saying that. And they call it a misinterpreted. I don't know how they would interpret it, but I would say it certainly doesn't do us any good whatsoever. And that's the standard I would use for it.
Well, for fear of the Jews is certainly very prominent in the John Gospel.
Oh, yeah, I know. But it comes from all these things, you know. And this certainly, if people believe that God is telling them that if they bless the Jews, they'll be blessed. And if they curse the Jews, well, he's going to curse them. Well, that sure as heck adds to that fear, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's terrible. Awful.
Well, I think it says Israel, though, doesn't it? See, the thing is, according to traditional Christian doctrine, the Jews are not Israel. The church is Israel, right?
Well, they bring up that the Jews are not Israel later on in this chapter, yeah. Well, that, you know, people, you know, they all have different interpretations of that, and they use it differently, all these
various
sects.
Well, it's this premillennialist Christianity that developed in the United States that gives the chosen people status back to the Jews. These are the people that are just crazy for supporting Israel.
Well, yeah, I know. Well, yeah, true.
The pulpit has also the mission of liberating the church from the error that Judah and Israel are synonymous. The reading of the scriptures, which confuse the tribe of Judah with Israel, and right, which interpret every mention of Israel as signifying the Jews, is at the root of more than one half of the confusion and division traceable in Christian doctrinal statements.
You know, these writers of, especially this one, the main writer that Henry Ford used, I guess that was Cameron. I get these men's names mixed up a little bit. I think that was Cameron, who was the writer and the editor of a newspaper editor, former, and so on. And that was, he had been Christian Identity, or at least he was British Israel or something. And then later, I guess he wasn't. He may have changed his mind somewhat on that. But you can feel the influence of that in all of this chapter where he's talking about Christianity and Israel and who the Jews are and so on. And he definitely says the Jews are not the people of the Bible. Today's Jews are not these people of the Bible. And he says that, and that's where it comes from.
Well,
but I don't want to get into a discussion about that.
That particular negation is a traditional Christian viewpoint, as I just said. But anyway,
okay.
The Jews are not the chosen people. Though practically the entire church has succumbed to the propaganda which declares them to be so. The Jewish tinge of thought has of late years overspread many Christian statements, and the uninstructed clergy have proved more and more amenable to Jewish suggestion. The flaccid condition of the church, so much deplored by spokesmen who had regard for her inner life, was brought about not by science, not by scholarship, not by the increase of light and learning, for none of these are antagonistic even to incomplete statements of the truth, but by Jewish-German higher criticism.
That's exactly right.
I'm not sure that is exactly
right. That is right. I looked into that at one time. Some years ago, I was looking into all this criticism of the, you know, modern Bible scholars, you know, talking about the Bible and so on, and what was real, what wasn't. And this whole German-Jewish area was very highly respected by the Germans, which it shouldn't have been. And so that's how they got themselves respectable in scholarly areas. By doing this Bible work as Jews, you know, they had some kind of special insight into it, supposedly. And these were German Jews who were mainly involved in this. But anyway.
Well, higher criticism is usually, today is usually called historical criticism.
Well, that's what it was. That's what it was.
Yeah. Well, I looked at...
Okay. Go ahead.
Supposedly, the founder of it was a man named Johann Gottfried Eichhorn, who published a book called An Introduction to the Old Testament in 1780-83. And I don't see any indication that Eichhorn was a Jew. He seems to have been a German.
Well, the Jews got into it, and the Jews and the Germans were collaborating, and, you know, the Germans thought the Jews had a lot to offer, and that's how that all got started. But I'm just talking real generally.
There might be Jews, it may be that Jews took a special interest in doing criticism of the New Testament, but
they were doing it all. Well, let's just see what this says, because we're not even halfway through the pages of this chapter, and we're already halfway through the time.
The defenders of the faith have fought long and valiantly against the inroads made by the so-called higher criticism, but were sadly incapacitated in their defense because they did not see that its origin and purpose were Jewish. It was not Christian, it was not German, it was Jewish. It is almost wholly discounted today in the practical life of the church, but it still adheres to the darker corners of the colleges, along with the red Bolshevism, which is taking root there under Jewish influences. Now, one of the first prominent doubters of the Old Testament, of course, was Voltaire, who was certainly not a Jew. Oops. Let the Christian minister who wishes to know the source of Jewish influence in the church look over the names of the more notorious German higher critics of the Bible, German in quotes, and consider their race. Add to them one Frenchman, an atheist, and a Jew, and you have modern liberal sources very complete. And the names given are Wellhausen, Strauss, Ewald, Kühne, Hitzig, and Renan. Doesn't mention Eichhorn there, who was the founder of the whole thing, and a German. It is perfectly in keeping with the Jewish world program that this destructive influence should be sent out under Jewish auspices, and it is perfectly in keeping with non-Jewish trustfulness to accept the thing without looking at its source.
You know, when they say, I just want to add this real quick, when they say the Jewish World Program, they're referencing the protocols there. That's kind of what they have in mind when they talk about a Jewish World Program. But anyway.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
A great many so-called liberals played the Jewish game for a time. They are now coming back to the old citadel, which stood in its own strength and without their patronage, while the fever of the higher criticism raged. The church is now victim of a second attack against her in the rampant socialism and Sovietism that have been thrust upon her in the name of flabby and unmoral theories of brotherhood and in an appeal to her fairness.
I thought it was pretty cool that they called brotherhood an unmoral theory.
Yeah. Flabby and unmoral. Yeah. Flabby and unmoral theories of brotherhood and fairness. Depends on who your brother is supposed to be, I suppose.
Right.
The church has been made to believe that she is a forum for discussion, and not a place for her annunciation. She has been turned from a voice into an echo of jangling
cries.
Yes, jangling cries. Jews have actually invaded in person and in program hundreds of American churches, with their subversive and impossible social ideals, and at last became so cocksure of their domination of the situation that they were met with the inevitable check. Clergymen ought to know that 7/8 of the economic mush they speak from the pulpit is prepared by Jewish professors of political economy and revolutionary leaders. They should be informed that economic thought has been so completely Judaized by means of a deliberate and masterly plan of camouflaged propaganda that the mass thought of the crowd, which is the thought mostly echoed in popular pulpits and editorials, is more Jewish than Jewry itself holds. In other words, the average Jew doesn't even think that Jewishly. The Jew has got hold of the church in doctrine, in liberalism, so-called, and in the feverish and feeble sociological diversions of many pulpits and adult classes. If there is any reason where a straight study of the Jewish question should be made, with the Bible always in hand as the authoritative textbook, it is in the modern church, which is unconsciously giving allegiance to a mass of Jewish propaganda. It is not reaction that is counseled here. It is progress along constructive paths, the paths of our forefathers, the Anglo-Saxons, who have to this day been the world builders, the makers of cities and commerce and continents, and not the Jews, who have never been builders or pioneers, who have never peopled the wilderness, but who move in upon the labors of other men. They are not to be blamed for not being builders and pioneers, perhaps. They are to be blamed for claiming all the rights of pioneers. Probably also for driving off the pioneers and dispossessing them. But even then, perhaps, their blame ought not to be so great as the blame that rests upon the sons of the Anglo-Saxons for rejecting the straightforward building of their fathers and taking up with the doubtful ideas of Judah. Colleges are being constantly invaded by the Jewish idea. The sons of the Anglo-Saxon are being attacked in their very heredity. The sons of the builders, the makers, are being subverted to the philosophy of the destroyers. Young men, in the first exhilarating months of intellectual freedom, are being seized with promissory doctrines, the source and consequence of which they do not see. There is a natural rebelliousness of youth which promises progress. There is a natural venturesomeness to play free with ancient faiths, both of which are ebullitions of the spirit and significant of dawning mental virility. It is during the periods when these adolescent expansions are in process that the youth is captured by influences which deliberately lie in wait for him in the colleges. True, in after years, a large proportion come to their senses sufficiently to be able to sit on the fence and see themselves go by, and they come back to sanity. They find that free love doctrines make exhilarating club topics, but that the family, the old-fashioned loyalty of one man and one woman to each other and their children, is the basis not only of society, but of all personal character and progress. They find that revolution, while a delightful subject for fiery debates and an excellent stimulant to the feeling of supermanlikeness, is nevertheless not the process of progress. And, two, they come at length to see that the Stars and Stripes and the Free Republic are better far than the Red Star and Soviet sordidness. When a Supreme Court justice addressed one of the greater American universities, a student came to him after a lecture and said, "It gave me so much pleasure to hear your lectures, for they were the first kindly words I have heard said about our government since the commencement of my university career." For years, the secular magazines have been carrying articles on the question, "What is wrong?"
There he goes. We just lost you.
American life.
Okay. Are you
Hello?
There?
Can you hear me?
I hear Hello? You now. Yes.
Okay. All right.
But you better speed up. We're halfway through, and we've only got about 18 minutes
Yeah,
left.
We'll be fine.
Yeah, you keep saying that. You can be reading 100 miles an hour at the end.
Did you hear that whole last paragraph?
Yeah, we heard it.
Okay. The trouble with the colleges has progressed along precisely the same lines that have been described above in connection with the churches. First, Jewish higher criticism in the destruction of young men's sense of respect for the ancient foundations. Second, Jewish revolutionary social doctrine. The two always go together. They cannot live apart. They are the fulfillment of the Protocols program to split non-Jewish society by means of ideas. It is not idle to attack the
It is idle.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
About to point people in the wrong direction there. It is idle to attack the unbelief of college students. It is idle to attack their radicalism. These are always the qualities of immaturity. But it is not idle to show that social radicalism, radicalism being a very good word, very sadly misused, and antagonism to the religious sanctions of the moral law, both come from the same source. Over the fountain of revolutionism and anti-Christian belief, place the descriptive and definitive term Jewish, and let the sons of the Anglo-Saxons learn from what waters they are drinking. That source is not Mosaic, but Jewish, and there is a world of difference between them.
Okay, let's continue.
The central groups of red philosophers in every university is a Jewish group, with often enough a Gentile front in the shape of a deluded professor, often enough. Some of these professors are in the pay of outside red organizations. There are intercollegiate socialist societies swarming with Jews and Jewish influences, and Jewish professors around the country addressing medics and lits and even the divinity schools under the patronage of the best civic and university auspices. Students' lecture courses are fine pasture for this propaganda. Intercollegiate liberal leagues are established everywhere, the purpose evidently being to give students the thrill of believing that they are taking part in the beginning of a great new movement, comparable to the winning of independence or the abolition of slavery. As Stein parties gradually cease, as a college diversion, red conferences will come in. It is part of the effervescence of youth. The revolutionary forces which head up in Jewry rely very heavily the respectability which is given their movement by the adhesion of students and a few professors. It was so in Russia. Everyone knows what the name student eventually came to signify in that country. And as a result, while Sovietists are glorifying the success of the revolution, men like Maxim Gorky are sending out appeals for food to prevent the intelligentsia from starving to death. The Jewish Chautauqua, which works almost exclusively in colleges and universities, together with Bolshevism in art, science, religion, economics, and sociology, are driving straight through the Anglo-Saxon traditions and landmarks of our race of students. And these are ably assisted by professor clergymen whose thinking has been dislocated and poisoned by Jewish subversive influences in theology and sociology. What to do about it? Simply identify the source and nature of the influence which has overrun our colleges. Let the students know that their choice is between the Anglo-Saxons and the tribe of Judah. Let the students decide in making up their allegiance whether they will follow the builders or those who seek to tear down. It is not a case for argument. Radicalism and religious indifferentism are states of mind. Normal men usually grow out of them in good time. Others are caught and held to the end. But treatment is not argument. The only absolute antidote to the Jewish influence is to call college students back to a pride of race. We often speak of the fathers as if they were the few who happened to affix their signatures to a great document which marked a new era of liberty. The fathers were the men of the Anglo-Saxon Celtic race. The men who came across Europe with civilization in their blood and in their destiny. The men who crossed the Atlantic and set up a civilization on a bleak and rock-bound coast. The men who drove west to California and north to Alaska. The men who peopled Australia and seized the gates of the world at Suez, Gibraltar, and Panama. The men who opened the tropics and subdued the Arctics. Anglo-Saxon men who have given form to every government and a livelihood to every people and an ideal to every century. They got neither their God nor their religion from Judah, nor yet their speech nor their creative genius. They are the ruling people, chosen throughout the centuries to master the world by building it ever better, and not by breaking it down. Into the camp of this race, among the sons of the rulers, comes a people that has no civilization to point to, no aspiring religion, no universal speech, no great achievement in any realm, but the realm of get. Cast out of every land that gave them hospitality, and these people endeavor to tell the sons of the Saxons what is needed to make the world what it ought to be. If our sons in college follow this counsel of dark rebellion and destruction, it is because they do not know whose sons they are, of what race they are the scions. Let there be free speech to the limit in our universities and free intercourse of ideas. But let Jewish thought be labeled Jewish, and let our sons know the racial secret. The warning has already gone out through the colleges. the system of procedure is already fully known, and how simple it is. First, this is what the Jews do, first, you secularize the public schools. Secularize is the precise word the Jews use for the process. You prepare the mind of the public school child by enforcing the rule that no mention shall ever be made to indicate that culture or patriotism is in any way connected with the deeper principles of the Anglo-Saxon religion. Keep it out, every sight and sound of it. Keep out also every word that will aid any child to identify the Jewish race. Then, when you have thus prepared the soil, you can go into the universities and colleges and enter upon the double program of pouring contempt on all the Christian landmarks, at the same time filling the void with Jewish revolutionary ideas. The influence of the common people is driven out of the public schools, where common people's influence can go. But Jewish influence is allowed to run rampant in the higher institutions, where the common people's influence cannot go. Secularize the public schools, and you can then Judaize the universities. This is the liberalism which Jewish spokesmen so much applaud. In labor unions, in church, in university, it has tinctured the principles of work, faith, and society. This will not be denied, because the proof of it is too thickly written over Jewish activities and utterances. Indeed, it is in exerting these very influences that Jewry convinces itself fulfilling its mission to the world. The capitalism attacked is non-Jewish capitalism. The orthodoxy attacked is Christian orthodoxy. The society attacked is the Anglo-Saxon form of society, all of which, by their destruction, would redound to the glory of Judaism. The list could be extended. The influence of the Jewish idea on Anglo-Saxon sports and pleasure, on the Anglo-Saxon Celtic idea of patriotism, on the Anglo-Saxon Celtic conception of the learned professions. The influence of the Jewish idea runs down through every department of life. Well, one very badly deluded Anglo-Saxon editor, wrapped up in Jewish advertising contracts, was heard to say, if the Jews can get away with it, then they have a right to. It is a variant of the answer of Jewish origin, which runs thus. How can a paltry 3 million run the 100 million of the rest of us? Nonsense. Yes, let it be agreed. If the Jewish idea is the stronger, if the Jewish ability is the greater, let them conquer. Let Anglo-Saxon principles and Anglo-Saxon power go down in ruins before the tribe of Judah. But first, let the two ideas struggle under their own banners. Let it be a fair struggle. It is not a fair fight when in the movies, in the public schools, in the Judaic churches, in the universities, the Anglo-Saxon idea is kept away from Anglo-Saxons on the plea that it is sectarian or clannish or obsolete or something else. It is not a fair fight when Jewish ideas are offered as Anglo-Saxon ideas, because offered under Anglo-Saxon auspices. Let the heritage of our Anglo-Saxon Celtic fathers have free course among their Anglo-Saxon Celtic sons, and the Jewish idea can never triumph over it, in university forum or in the marts of trade. The Jewish idea never triumphs until, first, the people over whom it triumphs are denied the nurture of their native culture. Judah has begun the struggle. Judah has made the invasion. Let it come. Let no man fear it. But let every man insist that the fight be fair. Let college students and leaders of thought know that the objective is the regnancy of the ideas and the race that have built all the civilization we see and that promise all the civilization of the future. Let them also know that the attacking force is Jewish. That is all that will be necessary. And it is against this that the Jews protest. You must not identify us, they say. You must not use the term Jew. Why? Because unless the Jewish idea can creep in under the assumption of other than Jewish origin, it is doomed. Anglo-Saxon ideas dare proclaim themselves and their origin. A proper proclamation is all that is necessary today. Compel every invading idea to run up its flag. All right.
Yeah. Well, we did finish. Good, good, good. That's because I didn't say anything. I kept quiet. And so that's a very strong ending. That was a very strong, that whole ending part, I think. You know, they're really going at it here, saying, you know, we're Anglo-Saxons, Celtics, and we're, you know, you're forcing this Jewish stuff on us. But, you know, at one point, they still have this hope. They're saying, let there be a fair debate here or a fair argument. If the Jewish idea is stronger, then let them conquer. But let's have let these two ideas struggle under their own banners. Let it be a fair struggle. Well, of course, it never has been. And so we've never had that. We've never been able to compare our own culture and ideas and so on, cultural ideas, to the Jewish ones in any kind of fair, honest way in public, right? So, yeah. Again, you know, what they were hoping for, the international Jew writers and Henry Ford, did not take place. They expected too much from all the people, not just from Jews, but also from their own people. People just won't stand up and demand anything. This is fear of the Jews is really something incredible. So your final comments, Hattie.
Well, I think he went a little over the top with this Bible criticism, saying science itself is a problem for Christianity. Historical criticism tries to either confirm or deny the story in the Bible based on evidence from archaeology, other historical sources, and so forth. And that has not been very good for belief in the Old Testament. Now, I can see how Jews would want to disrupt a belief in the New Testament, but I don't believe that they're interested. Well, I don't believe that it helps them to cast any doubt on anything in the Old Testament. Their interest is to keep the goyim believing those stories.
Well, it's how you interpret it. It's you know, I don't quite follow that. But all right, well, we are finished with tonight's show. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll be back next week with another very interesting chapter.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.